participate in this amazing meeting, where a bunch of individuals are turned into this fantastic group, which is interacting so beautifully, and some real communication of information is taking place, and it's, in any case, the subject matter is so interesting and so inspiring. It's really a pleasure to be here in this part of the world anyway, but thank you, Vidya, for your inspiration behind this. In the time that I have, I will not go into reviewing anybody's work, as I vaguely expressed in my abstract, but in many instances I will be paraphrasing other people's work, especially John Maynard Smith, Manfred Eigen, Stuart Kaufman, who have contributed in many important ways to the kind of more materialistic, if you like, thinking behind biological processes. I'm a statistical physicist, and I come from a background of phase transitions and critical phenomena, and especially at the critical point, you have a very special phenomenon going on. It's called scale invariance, or the fact that just at the critical point, the system looks statistically the same at whatever resolution or magnification you decide to view it. And this comes about because of a very specific fact, namely that the fluctuations diverge. The correlations, rather, between fluctuations in the system diverges. So that there is no intrinsic characteristic length scale left in the problem. That's why it becomes self-similar, if you like, looks the same at all scales. And this has been, for many of us, the paradigm of complexity, namely the presence of structures at all length scales and concomitantly at all time scales. So this brief outline points out to a few things that I will be, qualitative things that I will be saying regarding complexity, adaptation, optimization, and so on. And then I will try to illustrate these ideas or findings using a very matchstick model of gene regulatory networks. My hat's off to the previous speaker who did this wonderful job of first increasing the complexity of the models and then cutting them down to bare bones. It would be wonderful if we could do that in many other instances. Then I will, time permitting, and I think I will do what Yanni did last time in his lecture, namely I'll sort of take a pause, take questions and discussion and so on, and then I will give another instance which I think illustrates some of the points that I've been trying to make. Okay. I stress that I'm a statistical physicist because we do seem to have different paradigms in the way that we look at the world, and the discussion already came up in the opening lecture of Vidya and in everything that has followed. Biologists know so much, I feel totally humbled as a physicist. In front of them, because we physicists know really very little. A physical theory is a very simple set of expressions from which you can use mathematics to deduce various conclusions. But the amount of knowledge that goes into even one biochemical cycle is absolutely mind-boggling to me. The statistical physicist makes up for her his lack of knowledge by using statistics in the following way. If we don't know anything about a system, then all of its states are equally probable. Huh? That's the postulate on which statistical mechanics is built. If you have a system whose energy you hold fixed, so that all allowed states have the same energy, well, and you don't know anything more about it, then you make the postulate that you will treat all of the, you will postulate that they will, all the different states with that energy will appear with the same property. That's called the microcanonical ensemble for the pleasure of the physicists present. But from that you can derive the distribution of states in a situation when you hold the temperature fixed rather than the energy fixed. That gives you the Boltzmann factor, the probability of encountering the system in a state with some energy E. It becomes no longer trivial. It depends on the temperature. So we look at the world as ensembles of possible states, an ensemble being an infinitely large bunch of copies, identical copies of the system. And we want to know, if you look on that ensemble, let's say from an omniscient eye, and ask, well, how many of these members of the how many members of this ensemble are in this state or that state, and so on. You can make statistics. That really describes a statistical physics system, i.e., the microscopics corresponding to what you observe in the macroscopic world as thermodynamics. It really, so statistical physics really deals with probability distributions on these ensembles. As I mentioned already at the beginning, I mean when I say some system is complex that there are emergent observable structures, identifiable structures and interactions that come about as a result of perhaps very local interactions between the constituents of my system, and these structures may be either spatial or temporal, so they can involve clustering, as for example was demonstrated yesterday. They can involve periodicity or chaotic behavior. So this, the presence of many different length and time scales is what I mean by complexity. Of course, in a biological situation, the emergent structures at every different length or time scale may in fact be different, may correspond to different kinds of identities, different kinds of entities. Okay, so back to this theme which has been already broached. I will certainly take the attitude that there are physical, chemical, mathematical bases for the emergence of complexity, and you do not have to assemble a living being atom by atom. You perhaps had to start with amino acids, maybe with nucleic acids, maybe they themselves evolved in some way, as for example in the kind of autocatalytic cycles proposed by Eigen, and reached certain abundances that could then sustain self-replicating autocatalytic cycles. I don't want to speculate about that, but what I do want to assume in the rest of the lecture and in part show is that you can have non-adaptive complexity without any selection pressures to actually lead to an adaptation. The fact that many mutations can be regarded as neutral, that there is a lot of neutral variability has already been mentioned. As a physicist, I will assume that anything can happen physically, if it's physically allowed or chemically allowed. And as a result, there's a huge combination, a huge variety of combinations that can arise. And if the emergent feature as a result of a new combination that hasn't been tried yet, if it is not fatal to the organism, well, it will survive. And maybe this will, this has some effect on the phenotype that could not have been predicted before. Well, then maybe it will give it some sort of a fitness advantage over others, or maybe not. But the emergence of new features that happen to serve certain that happen to offer certain advantages to the organism should not be confused somehow with the emergence of functions before they come. The function is something that follows. The function is really what is emergent, I would like to say. A new combination, a new constellation of gene interactions or other features arising from them may give rise to a function that could not have been foreseen. This, unfortunately, is a tripping point of a lot of the popular biology literature and many textbooks, without any intention of promoting an idea of intelligent design, the narrative is so that evolution, as it were, foresees, previsions certain functions before they are even present in the organism, and then adapts the organism in the direction of their perfection. This really is something that we have to, I think, train ourselves to avoid. Another stumbling block is this idea of optimization. Now, very clearly, in the 19th century, or well, even before, I mean, the idea of adaptation was even there before Darwin. This was a qualitative concept, fine. Now, well, the mathematics for it, of course, already existed. We know what it is to optimize given a function, a cost function, or a fitness function, as you would call it. We know how to find the maxima or minima of that function. The trouble is, these problems involve incredibly many variables, some of which you're not even aware of. And the function itself, we usually do not know. So we should be a little more humble, I think, when we talk about optimization. Since natural selection is a very high dimensional optimization problem, if it is an optimization problem, that I'm ready to grant, one should also be aware of the fact that generically it's impossible to satisfy all the constraints on that optimization problem simultaneously. I mean, this is a lesson that we have learned from spin glasses in physics, and we know that there are many low-lying states which violate some of the constraints, but try to satisfy most. And there is no global minimum. So when you observe a spin glass, what happens? Well, it goes, depending upon the initial conditions, it goes to the nearest sort of low-lying state. And certain kinds of measurements involve averages, ensemble averages over these low-lying states. Other kinds of measurements might actually trace individual trajectories into the low-lying states. So what is observed is not, does not necessarily represent, mathematically speaking, an optimum, or even qualitatively speaking, an optimum. It is the best maybe that you have under those present conditions, and maybe violating a few of the constraints. Okay, so Behram was showing these beautiful pictures of clustering occurring under very simple dynamics of diffusion and birth and death processes. There is an even simpler not a process, but I will describe it as a process, in which one can find clustering, if you like, at all length scales, not just the length scale of the given squares or partitions. And this phenomenon is called percolation. And it gave rise to a lot of research because it had applications, not just in phase transitions theory, but in oil exploitation, drawing oil from sandstone, and the growth of neural networks, and so on. So this is an example of spatial complexity arising from a very, very simple geometrical phenomenon. The picture shows a screen, if you like, with pixels that have been blotted out, so white, or left in place. And you can think of it as a piece of wire netting which you keep snipping, for example. Clearly, if you snip too many wires, that wire netting is going to start falling into pieces. And there will come a point where you barely have a path which goes from one end of the system to the other. And if you look closely, this path is not at all obvious. It can be that it goes through a very few necks, and if you remove those necks, then you lose this connection. People don't use percolators anymore, but there used to be a machine which used to put on fire and make coffee. It was called a percolator. Yes? This is the covering box covering dimension, which is a good approximation to the Hausdorff dimension. The same as what's your name, please? Anand points out that this thing has a strange dimension, namely the mass grows with the linear dimensions not as 2, as you would expect from an ordinary two-dimensional object, but as some fraction. But more importantly, you see that this thing is not looking like the random, purely random situation which Behram showed yesterday, with the variance over the mean being essentially 1. It is very far from that. And the correlation function, that's whether this guy knows something about what this guy is doing in terms of whether it's occupied or empty, for example, decays with the distance not exponentially, as you would assume in many systems, in many well-mixed systems, for example, it decays as a power law. And this power law is the hallmark of this scale invariant behavior. This is a situation where density fluctuations and correlations between them are diverging. The correlation length has diverged, that's why you lose the exponential. You only have this power law. But this happens at only a critical concentration. That means you snipped so many wires that you finally have just one or two paths, and if you snip anymore, you lose the connectivity totally. Okay. Did you have a question? This is an example of a geometrical phase transition. At that critical point, you have this complexity coming in, this hierarchy of length scales and self-similarity. This is the simplest kind of self-organization that one can imagine. Now, here's an example of a growth model, which is a little more complicated, but very simple to state. This is called the flossing growth because the equations behind it involve the Laplacian. In fact, it's just a diffusion equation. So the idea is this. From far away, you release some particles, and they do Brownian walks, as was mentioned yesterday. So they diffuse, they step right and left, and in fact, they can have varying step sizes as long as the mean of the step size is finite. And they wander around. The moment they find part of the cluster already formed, or here the substrate, they stick on it. Okay? Now, the density of these walkers is given by Fick's law. And we assume that's d rho dt equal to the density, the diffusion constant times the Laplacian of rho. So it relates the time derivative to the spatial variation. Now, we assume that this is a steady state, so that the time derivative is zero. So the Laplacian of the Laplacian of the density of walkers here is zero. And then, when they stick, they are removed from the field of walkers. So it's a sink. The cluster is a sink of the Brownian walkers. Now, what is the probability of sticking anywhere on this cluster, or on this cluster, for that matter, if you left, if you used circular boundary rules? It turns out, and this you can check by Monte Carlo simulations, that the growth rule is given by a probabilistic rule, namely, the probability of sticking is largest where the gradient of the Brownian walkers is largest. That means where the density is depleting fastest. The direction in which the density is depleting fastest is the direction in which this cluster will grow. And you get this very interesting branching structure. This, for the physicists, it's the same equation solved by the electrostatic potential in this area, and the growth probability breaks, it corresponds to dielectric breakdown at that point, and it's proportional to the electric field, which is minus the gradient of the electrostatic potential. Well, show these figures to anyone, and in fact, you find them on many kinds of stones. I think we have a mineralogist or a geophysicist. And the people will say, ah, look at those fossils. Well, they're not fossils. They're just mineral deposits which have grown in this way that I have described. Diffusion limited aggregation.
Or drainage.
Sorry?
Drainage.
Yeah, well, drainage channels also have a way of looking like. Well, here is a petri dish. I'm sorry, the resolution of the picture is not so big. But this is bacteria with plenty of nutritious stuff, say sugar. And the sugar concentration is essentially constant over here, but of course solves the Laplace equation. The sugar molecules are diffusing. And the growth is in the direction of the fastest growth of the sugar molecules. Okay? There is absolutely no adaptation there. It just, to the bacteria, the availability of the nutrient, or rather the gradient in the availability of the nutrient is the driving force. Yes?
So surely the adaptation is the fact that you go up in the gradient, right? Because if you didn't have an adaptation, would you still expect the same behavior?
Well, I'm sorry, my Monte Carlo particles in the computer don't have any adaptation.
No, true.
They are told to do it.
So, I know, but you're, in a sense, you embodying the rule into your particles. In the sense that in bacteria, there are well-known chemical mechanisms, sensor mechanisms that can compute gradients and help the bacteria flow up the gradient. If you remove that, for example, would you expect the same growth?
Yeah, okay, so this is, of course, I mean, this is exactly the kind of discussion that's needed. See, up to now, I've been acting the rigorous statistical physicist, saying that if I left, I don't tell my Monte Carlo particles to follow the gradient. They just, you know, do Brownian motion and grow in a particular way. And then mathematically, I find that that is the direction of the greatest gradient. And I could be very happy with this and stop there. Don't ask any questions before you see this picture. This is work by Tomasz Wicek and some collaborators. And see, if you don't have enough nutrient, the strategy is changed completely. So if I were just looking at one kind of process and comparing it with a physical process which I knew about and stopped there, I would be making a very big mistake. They develop all kinds of different strategies. On soft agar, hard agar, and so on. So this is like, in Turkish we have an expression, if you want to stick a pin into somebody else, stick a bigger pin into yourself first. So it hurts. Okay. So one has to really check that one is exhausting the phase space. One is looking at neighboring sets of constraints and see how, if in the first case the adaptation was not obvious, as was now pointed by Mohinish, well, in these cases it will, you know, force itself on you. Okay. So, probably chastised by this example, I will now try to apply statistical ideas to modeling some gene regulatory networks. Networks are, of course, as everybody is familiar with now, neat ways of conceptualizing complex systems where you don't really have a metric distance between the individuals that are somehow interacting with each other. And these interactions can be extremely general, they can disregard the vagaries of space-time metrics and so on. And so we indicate them with links or edges between nodes, which correspond to the entities. And the distance between two nodes is thought of as the number of steps that they have to jump over before they get there. Now, the remark in the Petri dish slide was that we have to somehow make sure that we put sufficient information into the model that we're making for it to be able to respond to various ways in which that situation can be generalized and really be a faithful model of the system that you're trying to study. It does not suffice that it just looks like that, it just visually similar to what that system is doing for one set of conditions. So here, for a gene regulatory network, actually we started with RNA interference, but here I will present it only at the end. Also for RNA interference. It's clear that there is specificity to the binding of RNA molecules to messenger RNA, or the binding of growth factors or transcription factors to the promoter regions of genes. So we wanted to quantify the specificity of this information that has to be contained in that network for it to make sense, for it to really realistically describe that system. And this is the way we reason. We can, of course, model information by just a series of zeros and ones. here to be closer to home, I'm saying, okay, let's take four letters. Since you have four letters, you need two bits, say 0011, 1001 to code for all four characters. And if they occur with equal probability, the all four characters, the probability of encountering any one of them is 1/4. The probability of encountering the same series of length L for any given series, for talking now about series of the same length, is 1/4 to the L. And the probability of matching a sequence of length L at least once within a sequence of length K, where K is obviously bigger than or equal to L, can be computed. It's a very good approximation. I will tell you why it is an approximation. But since the probability of matching a series of the same length is 1/4 to the length of that series, L, 1 minus this is the probability that, no, in that particular series of length L, you don't have a match. So this is the probability of not matching. And if you, now here comes the approximation. If you assume that you place your little box at consecutive sites and ignore the correlations between those sites, you will have K minus L plus 1 trials for any given series of length K. So here, this is my probability of never matching in any one of the K minus L plus 1 trials. You subtract that from 1, that's the probability that you have at least one match in that series. So this is very elementary. But once you have this probability, you can do a lot with it. You can compute a lot with it. For example, given any series of length L, you know the probability of it being found by chance in a series of length L. And you can now construct a network which consists of nodes which carry these series tagged along with them, you know, like an ear tag. So each node on the network has an ear tag and it has various lengths. These lengths can have various distributions. Oops, I'm sorry, that went the wrong direction. Now, if you have a network with ear tags having an exponential distribution, you get a very complicated in degree and out degree distribution. I'll say what that is. In degree means the number of edges coming into a node. Clearly, this is a directed network because a small series is found in a longer one, so it's a direction. This is the out degree distribution. This is the in degree distribution. They're completely different. This has a this is a log log plot, so it has like two different power law regimes. And don't laugh, because this is a range that's very small. This is an analytical calculation, and the dots are the simulation. So I don't have to justify my scaling law there at all. Okay, so this was a starting point from which we decided, all right, we'll try to mimic the gene regulatory network of, well, where do you find the most data? This yeast. And now we had a problem, because given the fact that there are well-documented binding series for different transcription factors, there is no way, there was no way for us to associate the primary sequence of a protein with the binding sequence that it finally seeks in the promoter region of a gene. So here's what we did. This was an existential jump. I mean, we really got stuck there for a while. So this is a gene, this is a promoter region of that gene, and this is a protein that is manufactured by that gene. And now that protein, some transcription factor is tagged, that is given also an ear tag, which is now short and stands for its binding sequence. Okay? So this protein is born with a binding sequence which it will seek in the promoter regions of the different genes, and if it finds it, will bind. Now, these binding sequences are not given with probability 1. They have quite a bit of noise. So clearly, it doesn't have to find exactly the sequence that it's looking for. It's a little bit wobbly there. Well, how do you express that? Plus, the binding sequences are of different length. You have a length distribution of binding sequences. Well, we said, all right, so let's look at the information content of the binding sequences as they are given in the databases. And you have probabilities for finding a particular nucleotide in that sequence. Let's say the ith nucleotide in the jth slot. Okay, this is the Shannon entropy. Note that this is negative. And I say the relative information content because I subtract from that the information content of a perfectly random four-letter series of length L. This 2 comes from L times natural log 4. All right, so this gives me an effective length bitwise of this relative information content divided by natural log 2. And instead of looking at the absolute length of these binding sequences that can be very wobbly, the size of the letter is proportional to the probability of its being found, I have a shorter length, and I have therefore a shorter distribution of lengths for the binding sequence, and this is what it looks like. This is bitwise. Okay. The next thing is you look at the length distribution of the promoter regions. And
So the previous distribution is obtained by trying to maximize the information content.
No, we don't maximize. We are given. You see, you are given these probability matrices, which tell you this Pij is a whole matrix. 4 on one side and L on the other, where L is the length of the binding sequence. So it tells you, you know, in the first place, you have the letter T with probability.
I get it. So that's just the relative information content of different lengths.
Yes, as we load them down from the databases, there is no optimization here on our part. I mean, there is no fitting parameter at all. Okay. So that's what it looks like a Poissonian. We noted, but we couldn't really show why. And then there's a distribution, and people have studied this. So, I mean, again, studied databases. And you find that it sort of has this power law shape for yeast and other eukaryotes. So, all right, now we have two distributions, one for the short sequences, another for the long sequences, and we can calculate what the distribution is for the probability of placing an edge between any node, between any pair of nodes, excuse me. Well, we did that, and this is a particular representation of the gene regulatory network of yeast, the transcriptional regulatory network. It ranks nodes by their connectivity in a slightly technical manner. It's called the K-shell decomposition. And this is the model. Well, they look very similar, but maybe you'll say, maybe if I did just another graph, that would also look very similar, of course. I lost it. Well, let me tell you, if you do a Barabashi-Albert network, by the way, it has only three shells, because in a Barabashi-Albert network is essentially a tree. And this thing has, without any parameters, except for this one little exponent in the tail of the distribution of promoter regions, and we check that if you change that parameter, it doesn't really qualitatively alter the situation. Here you have nine shells, here you have nine shells. It just depends on the distribution of the shared amount of information between those long series and short series. Okay. And here we calculated all kinds of different measures of topological measures on the network. So here's the this is the total degree, so in and out. This is the in degree distribution, out degree distribution. The red dots are the yeast network themselves. The cloud of black dots come from an ensemble of 100 such networks that we simulate. And they're really lying on top of each other, the degree distribution. Now, we come to the connectivity, the clustering coefficient. The clustering coefficient is the density of triangles in your network, so the number of elementary loops. It's the probability that two nodes which are connected to a, say, grandfather node are connected between each other. And although this looks qualitatively very similar, you see this is a log log plot, and there is a factor of almost 10 in the clustering coefficient. So we did something else. Yuri Alon in the Weizmann Institute has defined these motifs that you can search for in any given network, the frequency, yeah.
So you said you had done it on an ensemble of networks, right? You done the calculation on an ensemble of networks, right?
Yes.
So how do you generate the ensemble?
For each member of the ensemble, you choose the same number of nodes as yeast about, and then you attach to each node a long sequence whose length is chosen out of the given length distribution, and a short sequence whose length is chosen out of that effective length distribution for the binding sequences. That is supposed to be the binding sequence that the protein coming from that node, you know, will look for. Right. And then you also you do this for not for all nodes, because not all nodes are producing transcription factors. You do it for proportion of them, that's a few. And then you actually search whether you find that binding sequence in the promoter region or some other. And you do this by kids you.
You're right. The elements of the ensemble are different because you're choosing it from two distributions.
I'm sorry, you're choosing it from what?
Choosing the transcription factor that you're searching from, the length of the transcription factor from a certain distribution, is it?
Yes, it's an empirical distribution which we got out from the probability for each transcription. So, I mean, you took those, compile this length, effective length distribution, and then chose our lengths from the computed length. So there is no one-to-one information in the model about particular genes or transcription factors or the promoter regions or their binding sequences. Everything is done on an ensemble basis. Okay. Now, since we saw that the triangle was somehow not sufficiently present, we started to look at the frequency of these motifs. Every time that you find a set of three connected nodes, you see if they make this pattern or that pattern with the arrows, mind you. If something is connected both ways, like here, that means this is controlling that and that's controlling. And here we have the model frequencies and their randomized version. And then here, these are different databases with the frequencies that well, we have to calculate the frequencies. I think now they do. The frequencies of the various motifs, and their frequencies in the randomized version of the sample. Well, it turns out that it takes too long to look at this, but the differences between the actual empirical frequencies and the randomized versions are not that remarkable. And our model differs from the randomized version in the same direction as the empirical networks do, but not sufficiently. Okay, so clearly we're missing something in the model. We did the same thing for E. coli. We did this whole modeling for E. coli where you have operons rather than just one gene controlling another and so on. We took all that into account and then we looked at the motifs. And we have, again, a deficiency in, especially here, you're impossible to read, but this is not found. Not found. Why? These are controlling both ways, the edges which go both ways. They simply were not present. Higher correlations arise between nodes when you have duplications of genes with their regulatory regions. In that way, the same the two genes will be controlled by the same transcription factor. Even if you allow sometimes for subsequent mutations, and they may again with this kind of duplication and divergence scheme end up. Introducing self interactions and both interactions both ways and so on. So these kinds of processes are known to occur and they will lead in the right direction if you incorporate them into the model. Okay. I think I will just stop here for questions and discussion. I think you have listened to me for long enough. And then I will just say a few words about how one may think of evolving ensembles of such networks. And then I will say a few words about RNA interference. Yes.
I have a question about the approximation of ignoring correlations in the sequence. So as there are in the genome correlations and basically any length scale. So did you check what's the effect of introducing correlations?
I'll show you in the case of RNA interference. The effect is very little. We generated Markov series with one neighbor and two neighbor correlations incorporated, and so on. And they have really, you know, second, third order. You're very right, we're worried about this, but for this calculation, we didn't have to do that. The worst criticism can come from the fact that we're looking at each, let's say, trial as independent, although you move by only one bit. But this we also showed, we were able to do a Meyer F function expansion on that and show that to the first order there's no function. So it's okay.
Other questions?
Okay, take a deep breath then and we go on. So Boolean networks have been mentioned, and I don't know if everybody is familiar with them, so I thought I would just flash you this. Maybe I get some light. Is this blackboard visible from the back? It's too small. Okay, I'll try to, but you see more or less the pictures?
Yeah.
Okay. So, So Stuart Kaufman, as was mentioned, and some other people have been involved in the development of this idea, which is extremely elegant. It is the reduction of a regulatory network to its real bare bones, so that the state of a node
given, that's why the name Boolean, has only two states. It's either 1 or 0. So all the x's are 0 or 1. 0 if it is not being transcribed, and 1 if it is being transcribed. Two states only. The edges have arrows on them, clearly their direction. So if this node is producing some protein which regulates that node, then you have to draw an arrow like that. This can be, of course, self-suppressing or self-promoting, so it can have self-interactions. And this is just a topological, let's say, depiction of a small network. Now, let's see how it decides, how this node decides on the basis of information coming into it, what kind of a signal it's going to send to the next node. And there, this is amazing. Stuart Kaufman is a physician. And, but he really made the statistical physicist's choice. So, well, we don't know. Okay, so what do we do? Let's assign to each node a Boolean function, which is a function of all the states of the nodes that are sending edges to a given node. So this has two incoming edges. If x1, the output of this is 1, so this edge carries a value of 1, or say the output of this is 0, this edge carries with it a value of 0. So we can make, for all incoming arrows, we can make a list, and we can make a whole table of all possible configurations of zeros and ones here, and assign to the outcome, that's the output, either a 0 or a 1 randomly. But once you make this assignment, then it's fixed. You don't change it. So in a sense, once you determine what the Boolean function is, the rest, the evolution, is deterministic. Now clearly, such a system with, say, 3 nodes, with 2 states for each, is going to have 2 to the 3 states, 8 states. If you have n nodes, you have 2 to the n states. And that's a huge number when n is large. And keeping tables of such things where you list all possible incoming states and assign values to the output, that's mind-boggling. It takes too much computation. So many other people have done this, but the way we did it was to assign a mask, so another ear tag, to each node, and then compare the incoming signals. And if for that signal that the ear tag has a 0, the incoming should be a 1 for it to have a contribution to this sum, where we put the XOR, the exclusive OR function, to connect the incoming value with the mask for each incoming edge. And then we count the number of ones we have from that logical function. So it just compares the incoming signal with the value of the mask at that point, and either one of them, and only one of them, should be 1. And then you sum all the true values you have, all the ones that you get from this, and they should be in the majority. If they're in the majority, you get a 1 output. If not, you get a 0. But this is the description of the Boolean net, and it turns out that these even very small networks can have very rich behaviors. Yes. Sufficient information. So my mask, that's one order of one, somehow was for us computation. We said, look, let's assign one mass and then compare the incoming stuff to that. That still carries some information. A general idea is like this. So imagine that my mass is 1 and 0. So my mass has a 0 and a 1. And I have two incoming edges. So I'm looking at this node. And if this has a 1 and a 1, what is the outcome? This 1 and 0, so that's fine. That's an exclusive OR will give you a true there, so the outcome would be okay. So I have for the first term, I have a 1 plus, so I'm now summing over the outcomes. The second term will give me a 0, because both are 1. That's a 0. Well, I'm in a situation where I can't decide, so I should, that we did randomly. But so let's put a third guy. Imagine that I have three incoming edges. I have another one here. Three characters in my mask. And all of the incoming ones are 1s. The first one gave me a 1. The second one, 1, 1, gave a 0 for the exclusive OR. The third one was also a 1, 1. That also gave a 0. That's 1. Well, 1 out of 3 is not the majority. So this is going to give me a 0. Okay? But if I had a 0 here, that would change the situation, because this would give me a 1 for with the exclusive OR. This would give me a 1 with the exclusive OR, so I would have a second 1. This would give me a 0, okay. But now the sum is 2, and 2 out of 3 is the majority, so in this case, I would have a 1 as the output. So there is some computation going on.
Can we continue this later? You might run out of time. Please, during the question session or later on.
Okay. This was just to have some dynamics built into the system without blowing up the problem to a major proportion. And now, what does evolving mean? We just use the genetic algorithm, which involves the as I'm sure many of you know, it's now a standard numerical routine which can be found on standard computer programs. You somehow boil down your problem to a series, some code, and you have a cost function. That cost function can be computed from that series, right? And the rule can have a step function or can be more complicated, you will compute the fitness, if you want to say fitness, that's fine, of each series. You will decide if it is above a threshold or if it has a particular value or whatever. If the fitness allows it, you will duplicate those codes. You will mutate them, and then you will remove the same number of individuals from the population so that the total population size stays the same. And this you can do in various ways. You can do it one individual at a time, at each time step, or n individuals at each time step. But this is a convergent algorithm for all kinds of optimization problems where it would be impossible. It's a heuristic for very high dimensional optimization problems. And it's a very good heuristic. It doesn't necessarily get the global maximum or something if such a thing exists. It's a very good heuristic. Okay, so the idea was, all right, how do we define the fitness function? Because the fitness, the measure of fitness that is usually, used in such simulations is the distance, or a function of the distance from what's called the wild type, which is supposed to
be the best adaptive one. And this is clearly a teleological kind of problem. You know, you aim for something that you already know. But so we had to invent a fitness function. And the fitness function we decided to use was the following. Look at the dynamics on this on these networks, and we had seven nodes. That was about as big as we could deal with. Seven nodes, and an ensemble, a population of 200. And for each starting point, for each initial condition, where you set the values of these nodes to 0 or 1, you run the dynamics and see if it goes to a point attractor, a fixed point, or has some longer trajectory. Clearly, these trajectories cannot be, strictly speaking, chaotic, because it's a finite state system. Eventually, it will come back and repeat. But if the trajectory is about as long as 2 to the n, that's the phase space of the network, then we call it chaotic. And so our cost function was the length of the trajectory. And then we took an average over all the initial conditions, and that gave us a number which allowed the particular network with that particular wiring to be kept in the, so to be reproduced and allowed to propagate in the population. And with that, the score is the length of the trajectories averaged over all bases of attraction. And that's the number of steps. It goes very, very quickly down to 1. And we were keeping the degrees fixed, because otherwise it just throws out edges, and then you don't end up with anything interesting. And we were able to look at the motif counts when we did. And unfortunately, the motifs are numbered a little bit differently on this. I couldn't redraw the graphs, but this is the initial distribution of motifs, like I showed, three motifs in a previous diagram. Now, after something like 500 steps, many of them have been eliminated, and the ones that really survive are this guy, that's number 1, this is 1, okay? Number 3, which is this linear thing, and number 13, which is two arrows emanating from here. This is two arrows coming into that. And that's essentially
Well, you could have told me, you could have guessed this without going through the trouble of actually doing this genetic algorithm thing. But it just tells you that you can, for example, yes.
I am already 1 hour, 10 minutes.
Well, okay, so I have 10 minutes, maybe 5 minutes. This is, in some way, not a very bad mimicking of an adaptive strategy, where you would like, for example, if you have tissue that's differentiating or something, that the cell decides what it's going to be and not keep switching between eyelashes and intestines or something. So you would like the attractor to be a point attractor. And so you can select for it. And when you do select for it, you do get something that is not far from the kind of motifs that you find in excess abundance in real gene regulatory networks. Okay, so in my last 5 minutes, I will talk about RNA interference. We sort of made a big splash with two Nobel Prizes, Fire and Mellow, and these are all headlines from Nature. So that. Does anybody not know what RNA interference is? Physicists wouldn't know. Do you want me to tell you? I'll tell you, just for the sake of how something can be narrated in different ways. So here's what a Nature article will tell you. Well,
you have some enzyme called the dicer, and when it finds non-coding RNA, which can fold down itself like that into a double-stranded hairpin, or some double-stranded RNA, the probably so, which is never mesh, it can cut these up into small strands of about 22 meters high. And then, if you have some messenger RNA in the cell, these short sequences can go and bind on top of the messenger RNA and prevent it from being transcribed. So this is a way to suppress that particular protein.
And the important thing is, of course, this is the only immune mechanism that plants have, apparently, and it is an immune mechanism that we also use in the background. And there is a proliferation of names, like microRNA, small interfering RNA, and so on, Okay, so here's the story told differently. Please scream if this is wrong in places that I heard.
So first thing you need to know is that the viral infection means the insertion of the viral genome stripped from it from its capsid. It's double-stranded RNA. Okay. So the cell somehow has some mechanism for recognizing and attacking double-stranded RNA. That seems reasonable. So this seems to have evolved. However, the problem is this enzyme called the dicer, in fact it's not one enzyme, several enzymes, have also other functions. I mean, on the side, if a counter double-stranded RNA, it can go and snip it at equally spaced points or with an interval about 22 nucleotides. Now, these small segments are called short interfering RNA, and they can go and bind on top of these messenger RNAs and suppress them. And especially if those messenger RNAs are coming from transcriptions of viral material that has been inserted into your genome, then this will prevent the virus from being able to reproduce. However, note that if some viral RNA has been inserted into the genome and its viral transcription or messenger RNA has been excluded into the cytoplasm, this messenger RNA is going to have many sequences that match exactly with that double-stranded RNA that has been cut up into pieces. And so therefore, the sequence matching is not completely providential or adaptive or anything like that. It is so by nature. By definition, it's the same material. One you have caught before it got inserted into the genome, the other one has been inserted into the genome, transcribed, and been sent out, and of course they match. And they match via Watson-Crick pathway. And the more you read about it, the more exciting the story becomes, because then you find out that there is endogenous so-called double-stranded RNA, and in our DNA there are many non-coding regions, and many of them, lo and behold, are palindromic sequences that can fold on top, you know. That can fold into hairpins and form double-stranded RNA. And these, of course, also get diced to form short interfering RNA. There are other non-coding areas which apparently have viral origin of some very ancient archaic processes of either lateral gene transfer or viral infections or whatever. And these, when they are transcribed and excluded from the nucleus, they are also diced into confetti or about the same way. It's always the dicer type of enzymes doing this. And they can also suppress some messenger RNAs, some proteins. Some of them coming perhaps from viral infections, others not, and these others not are really an integral part of the gene regulatory system of the network. Well, so we did the same strategy, length distribution of the untranslated regions of the messenger RNA, which are bound by these short confetti. And here is the degree distribution of the microRNA to messenger RNA network in humans, with the red dots showing the empirical data. And these two are slightly two different ways of fitting. They stem from taking the point-by-point distribution. That's this one. This is fitting a function to this distribution and then drawing your lengths from that. That's the solid line. The solid line, actually, that we thought was a very decent kind of, you know, zeroth order null model that could account for the microRNA messenger RNA interaction network. In fact, then we did it for four other organisms. A worm, a frog, and a cat. But here we had a chance of a Popperian falsification of our claim. You see, if this was the whole story, then if you look at the network of microRNA to microRNA connections, where the edges are inserted every time this microRNA 1, yeah, I should have put indices here, and that other microRNA bind the same messenger RNA. So if you know, these two brothers are dating the same messenger RNA, then we put an edge between them. And if they are binding in common W such messenger RNAs, the edge has a weight W. Okay, and this can be worked out, again, from available data on the internet. If what I told you was the whole story, all that you needed to do would be to take the adjacency matrix A, that's if Aij, the elements of this matrix, are equal to 1, if I is connected to 2, I is connected to J, and 0 are connected. So you take A transpose times A, and that gives you exactly the adjacency matrix with the weights for the microRNA network. All right, so let's see if it works. Quite decidedly doesn't. Huh? Well, actually, we first did a human, and it looked wow. No. But this is bovine, this is frog, extrapolates, and this is CAS. Doesn't, and moreover, there is a lot more structure. The red is always the beta. There is a lot more structure. These oscillations superposed on the curve, which we can explain. I mean, we know where they are coming from, but they are totally absent. They just come from combinatoric effect. They are absent from the beta. This we have not even bothered to submit. We don't understand. Maybe, and this will be my concluding remark, maybe we are trying to read too much into the network. Maybe the information there deciding on this network is really much less, or at least is of a different nature. Consider the following problem. You have S independent constraints, that conditions that have to be fulfilled for an edge to be established. And you have independent, these conditions have independent probabilities of being satisfied, and each of them has a different probability, pi, and these of course, I can write them in terms of logarithms to the base 2 as, say, 2 to the minus alpha I. So each pi can be an explanation in terms of the alpha. So now, if you want, if these are all independent, the probability of satisfaction of this whole set S of independent conditions is the product of their probabilities. The natural log of that is the sum of these exponents. Well, if you have a large number of such random numbers, and alpha are called random numbers because I don't know it yet, you have the central limit theorem acting here, which means the distribution of the probability of establishment of these edges, or the satisfaction of these constraints, whatever they are, is log normal. The logarithm of the probability is distributed normally, namely via a Gaussian distribution. So maybe this is all that's operating there, and this is why you get these beautiful, smooth, pure, log normal looking curves. But we don't know. So there's always further questions to ask, further quantities to compute, to check that you're really capturing the essence of the problem when you're doing null models the way we're doing. I perfectly agree with Vera that now the biologists, however, should really compare their models or their workings, their data, with the, what comes out of the well-validated null models rather than totally random networks, for example, in the case of networks. So this gives you a starting point on which historically evolution may have acted, as there may have been selection pressures that made these networks, say, to evolve in ways that we cannot mimic with such a null approach or neutral approach that we have at the moment. Or it may not have been this way historically. We have no way of proving this at the moment. But this at least gives you the bare bones of the topology behind what is really being observed, or the kind of statistics behind what is being observed. I will end with saying that removing, I mean, these kinds of things I've said by many people, but removing the purpose or the directionality or the determinism, the design, if you like, from evolution, from the fulfillment of greater functions and so on, pushes us one further rank down, perhaps, in our status in the universe. But I think that's a good humble point to start from, and I think that even agrees more. That resonates even more closely with Piety than others. Thank you very much.
Manish.
So, it's not well formed, but I don't know if it makes sense. So here's one way that I think about such processes coming from cognition. I think it's applicable over here as well. Is that suppose you have lots and lots of little processes, all of which are adaptive in the technical sense, all of which are biological, that they don't come from real purely physical processes and so forth. But that the sum of all of them, when you put them all together, approximate a process that looks something like something that's random. That is, that you know, when you, for example, in Bahram's case as well, when you can make migration moving from very simple parts of your model, which on the face of it look very simple, might come about through the combination of many, many small, yes, purely adaptive, purely biological things, but the sum of them looks like some physical process. And the reason I say this is because even when you have your network, right, why do you have the constraint, if you want, that the average path length must be minimized? Why can it not be maximized? Why can it not be at a certain level?
No, for that I have a very the process of cell differentiation state. Okay? You want that cell to, you know, end up in some particular tissue and not keep flip-flopping all over the
place. But see, now when you talk about want it to be in some tissue, again, you're giving it some kind of purpose.
Of course. Thank you very much for doing but it would be disruptive to the organs if a liver cell, after 6 hours decided to become a hair cell and then later decided to become a liver.
Again, using the same language, which is that it decides to be that it has.
That's not fair. Decides to, in this case, just means it goes from, given a particular dynamics, it goes from a particular initial condition to, this is now its phase space, which is given by 2 to the n different points, each of which correspond to a set of zeros and ones. If you have n nodes, you have this many entries in that. Okay. And the dynamics is completely deterministic. I mean, you could put stochasticity there too, but the computation at each node has been specified. And it goes under this deterministic dynamics. Maybe it has some transient, and then say it goes and starts flip-flopping between two points. That's some periodic action. I mean, we have seen, of course, that there are many cases where that is even desirable. So we didn't specify the desirable from the point of view of the organism in order that the organism survives. But I think you see my meaning. I mean, this is an automaton which is doing something. And whether it has a very true attractor or after some transient it goes and sticks at one point, and so do a whole other bunch of initial conditions, the whole big base node attraction also go and stick at this point. These are qualitatively different things, and we thought that these kinds of topologies that we didn't even mutate the function would give rise to a situation that was that would enhance the fitness of an organism. So here, it is admittedly so that we were purposefully putting in a target, but that target was not a distance from a wild card. It was something intrinsic to the network, the length of its trajectory.
Maybe we could back up. We don't have a question yet.
No? So the one problem I see with, let's say, null models is that sometimes you have different simple models that give the same macroscopic outcome. And then, of course, in a biological context, natural selection might well prefer one of those macroscopically equivalent processes.
You're perfectly right. I mean, that's why model validation is very important. And to do it seriously, you have to look at the same object from various aspects. You have to compute, let's say, different things about it. If you just look at the degree distribution, zillions of different kinds of networks have the same degree distribution, but they're totally different topologies, for example. Right? So you ought to also look at different quantifiers, or you should look at different kinds of behaviors of the dynamics on the network within the network context. But you're perfectly right. I mean, look, the galaxy distribution in space can be, this was before dark matter.
I just wanted to ask a question, whether you are not in the position that Kepler was when he selected
the orbits are elliptic. And I wonder whether you are not in the same position, you and people who are trying to make this square peg fit in the red.
Yeah, okay, I have one comment to that. I didn't include those features, but when we started to do E. coli, it really didn't work. Okay, we were not being able to use the genome of the bird. This was in 2008. And then we found out that, first of all, the data about the binding sequences was very dirty. There were many situations where two completely different sequences were bunched together in the same probability agents, for example. Or there were situations where the thing binded with a skip, and the middle was included in the probability agents, stuff like that. And then in 2010, the data improved step by step, version by version. And finally, in the last version of the venue database,
one brief last question, maybe you are you know that you could wait for a while, yeah, for you, very briefly.
The predetermined function, the predetermined function is the cost of the evolution of situation.
Then how would you explain natural extinction? Is the function over?
No, I don't. I mean, this is a toy game. It has more sense.
Okay. A second absolutely last question.
Yeah. My conclusion. You apply Boolean
logic there. And essentially using those microcanonical vulnerability. Which is equilibrium thermodynamics.
No, I have it was the strongest evidence of evidence to say that the nucleotides occur with the same probability 1/4. But if you took them, you know, they deviate really very little, about 1 or 2% about that 0.25 probability. And if you put those in, it doesn't really change the picture. There's no
thermodynamics
behind this. This is not a
third
system. It's just
an equiprobable assumption. And that holds good even when you are far from equilibrium.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yes. What we were doing was just geometrical assembly, not really a dynamical process, the assembly of the radio. That's a very interesting
change. Very briefly now, Kruti has an announcement to make, but even before she speaks, let me say, shall we assemble here at 2 o'clock after lunch? Because after she's through, we break up for lunch.
This is regarding the travel reimbursement forms. Those who have filled out your forms, kindly give them to me.